Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast. My name is Mark Williams and I'm delighted to announce that my guest on this episode is Mr. Charles Haskell. Charles is the Decarbonisation Programme Manager for Lloyd's Register's Decarbonisation Hub. Charles graduated with a master's degree in engineering from the University of Bristol in the UK in 2001 and then promptly joined Lloyd's Register, where he has remained for 20 years. He began by working in ship repair and new building yards in the UK, France, Poland and South Korea before moving to the Middle East in a new role conducting audits and surveys. He then transitioned into client management and led Middle East and Africa business development teams before returning to the United Kingdom to resume a similar role. During this time, he's worked with several clients on zero emission projects, and accordingly, Charles was appointed to his current role at the launch of the Lloyd's Register Decarbonisation Hub in October last year. So, Charles, welcome to the programme. It's delightful to have you on.
Thank you very much, Mike.
So let's get straight into it. We haven't had a class society on the podcast before, so we're very pleased to get you on. And perhaps you could tell us about the Decarbonisation Hub and how class societies more generally are assisting shipping to decarbonise.
Okay, thank you. The Maritime Decarbonisation Hub is a joint initiative between the Lloyd's Register Group and the global charity, the Lloyd's Register Foundation. And the purpose of the Maritime Decarbonisation Hub is to accelerate the safe and sustainable decarbonisation of the maritime sector through leadership, collaboration, and evidence-based decision-making. Why has this been done? Let's go back to 2016. The world came together to take action. 196 nations signed the Paris Agreements at the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. It committed nearly every nation, including all major carbon-emitting countries, to keep the global temperature rise this century to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. It also committed signatories to pursue efforts to limit the temperature increase even further to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And the agreement underpins the transformation of economies using fossil-based fuels to alternative energy sources and technologies. From this, Lloyd's Register, together with UMass, published some papers showing that the shipping sector would need to reach, showing what the shipping sector would need to do to reach these targets. And this research really showed that shipping would have to reduce CO2 emissions by 50% in absolute terms by 2050 compared to 2008 levels. In real terms, owing to growth in the shipping and global trade and potentially other sectors decarbonizing, this would equate to 85% reduction of CO2 in operational intensity. So what this really means is we're going to have an energy transition. The evidence is clear from this that this has got to be the decade of action on decarbonization of shipping. If we look at other energy transitions, they've taken a long period of time. If we look from coal to oil within the shipping segments, probably 50 years of transformation for that. And in that scenario, we're moving from a fuel, we're moving to a fuel which was easier to transport, easier to store, safer to handle, and was cheaper and cleaner. And in these cases, apart from the cleaner, none of these aspects are really there. So there's no real drive except the climate emergency. So since these papers, we were working on a number of projects of zero carbon fueled projects. We had the hydrogen demonstrator, the Hydroville, which is active on the water in Belgium, running on hydrogen. And it's a small passenger ferry, but that was really a socialization project and to get the people to see the possible. And another project ongoing is the Castor Initiative, which is a joint project between Lloyd's Register, MISC, Samsung Heavy Industries, and MAN Energy Solutions. And more recently, that brought in the MPA and the Singapore flag and Yara as a zero carbon fuel supplier for ammonia. So we had these ongoing projects, but part of it was really to lead the drive and lead the conversation. So in 2020, Lloyd's Register Group and the Foundation created the Lloyd's Register Maritime Decarbonisation Hub with the purpose of really continuing the debate moving forwards and ensuring that there's clarity in the subject amongst the industry and across all the stakeholders. There's a number of projects now going on globally. You often see press releases nearly every week of a new project coming along on shipping, and particularly where we see these projects and class involvement for decarbonisation of shipping from a class side, this is really to ensure the safe adoption of these fuels on the vessels, mm-hmm. that they can be carried, burnt in a safe manner, and the people on board the vessels are kept safe. So the role of class societies in this whole process is safety assurance and ensuring we get there. The role of the Maritime Decarbonisation Hub, aside from the class aspect of Lloyd's Register, it is really to ensure the momentum is continued, create debates where it's required, but really provide evidence on the safety of fuels, but also the economics and sustainability, and really addressing the issues across the stakeholders to unlock the challenge.
So thanks. This is more than a TIC role at Glass Society. So TIC, yes. Testing Inspection Certification.
Yes.
So this is reaching beyond LR's in-house expertise.
Yes, very much so. So it's very much creating a team of analysts, risk specialists, because we still want to look at the safety of the fuels, particularly on land-based as well. This challenge goes beyond shipping. We've got to look at the storage of the fuel because we don't want to have a solution of a ship being ready, but the other aspects not being covered. And also the ships won't be ready if there is no fuel ready as well. So it's about engagement across multiple stakeholders, from fuel supply all the way through to production, storage, including the ports, and then ultimately the ships, and to the end users, the consumers. And part of it is actually getting their buy-in, and that's where we're seeing a lot of push as well in the industry, is from the end consumers.
Yes, because, I see Lloyd's Register has announced this week, we reported it on Ship Energy, that Lloyd's Register is one of the founding organisations, one of nine founding organisations, I think, in the Maritime Technologies Forum. So along with the likes of ABS and DNV, Japan's Ministry of Land, Infrastructure, Transport and Tourism, which is its shipping ministry effectively, and the Norwegian Maritime Authority and the UK's Maritime Coast Guard Agency. So plenty of policy leadership, but this has to be a commercial reality, doesn't it? As much as it is a policy reality.
I think one of the things we need in the industry is clarity and unification. And this can only be achieved by collaboration. So the Maritime Technology Forum is really there to ensure that one voice is coming out. We've got the policymakers engaged. We've got the flags engaged to make sure that there is one message going forwards. There's alignment on safety standards because we can't have different safety standards coming out of this. We know that the new fuels are not as safe. If we look at hydrogen, and ammonia in particular, is these fuels and certainly not as safe as today's fuels. And therefore, we can't compromise on safety. And therefore, I wouldn't say it's a commercial venture. And that's why the flag administrations are there as well. It's to ensure that amongst all of this is that the safety regulations are unified and will actually create that environment of the new fuels being safely adopted.
Thanks, Charles. So let's think about how we move through the safety prism, if you like, or how we go from where we are to planning where we want to be in the future. I'm reminded 4 years ago of a quote from LR, which was that, quote, anyone planning to finance, design or build a ship in the 2020s must consider how it would switch to a non-fossil fuel later in its operational life. So this isn't just about building new ships to meet the new reality. We've also got 80,000 ships or whatever it is in the global fleet that also have to transition to the new reality as well, don't we? So what progress have you seen towards this, and how has LR assisted in that progress?
Progress has certainly been made, and it is moving quickly. Dare I say it still needs to be moving quicker. But there are a number of projects and certainly higher level ambitions coming out of the market. We've seen the recent announcements from Maersk, and they're moving their timeline forwards. But also coming back to collaboration across the industry, we talked about the Maritime Technology Forum, but if we look at other collaborations, particularly the Getting to Zero Coalition, where there's numerous companies across multiple stakeholders coming in and sharing a common interest in a very open and transparent forum. But also sort of coming from this and from the Global Maritime Forum as well, you've got your Poseidon Principles and the Sea Cargo Charter. So the Poseidon Principles, they were launched in June 2019, and these were developed in an effort spearheaded by global shipping banks, Citi, Societe Generale, and DNB, in collaboration with leading industry players such as A.P. Moller - Maersk, Cargill, Euronav, Graham Car Carriers, Lloyd's Register, and Watson Farley Williams. And the Poseidon Principles really establish a framework for assessing and disclosing the climate alignment of ship finance portfolios. So they set a benchmark for what it means to be a responsible bank in the maritime sector and provide actionable guidance on how to achieve this. Moving on, we've got the Sea Cargo Charter released last year. And this is very similar to Poseidon Principles, but it was amongst the charterers. So we've seen a drive amongst other stakeholders in the industry, which has been very powerful, because it's not just about the IMO and the regulators. It's about multiple carrots and sticks, so to speak, mm-hmm. to help the industry transition. In terms of the shipping side, we have seen the projects moving forward. Again, I come back to the Castor initiative, which is one of the projects we've been working on, with the one which really has all the key stakeholders involved. And when we look at that, we've got MAN Energy Solutions with an engine potentially ready by 2024, 2025 to run on ammonia as a fuel. So from a technical perspective, there can be ships on the water by that time. So we could have zero carbon fueled ships on the water by 2024, 2025. The issue there is actually the fuel supply and where we're going to get the green fuel from as well. So part of what we're working on in the Maritime Decarbonisation Hub is across those stakeholders as well, trying to pull in those fuel suppliers such as Yara and others, and to begin to get scalable pilot projects on the ground. And I think that word is key for scalable. We need to transition the whole industry by 2050, and it's going to be a very quick energy transition. If we compare it to the others before, and that's key for the scalability. Any project is warmly welcome, but we really do need the scalable projects where we can take learnings from that project and rapidly scale up. It's going to be an S-curve transition from 2030 to 2050. Ambitiously, maybe, but 5% of fuels 5% of the use of fuels being zero carbon by 2030, scaling up to at least 50% by 2050. Mm-hmm. And it's a big tall ask of the industry. So any projects we need need to be repeated or to be able to scale up from an A to B operator to then running to a line of service and continuing beyond. But also when you create that network around the ports is for other shipping types to be able to feed off that. So we've seen progress, but really the challenge is less now about the ship. It's about the fuel supply, the infrastructure and the storage. And that's the challenge we're facing at the moment.
Yes, the investment has to come from the energy companies, doesn't it, to sort of make these fuels available. Otherwise, you know, we can't burn them in ships. And there's an economic angle to that at the moment, because there isn't really a price for maritime ammonia fuel or maritime hydrogen fuel. It's very difficult to compare. We did some back of the envelope calculations, and envelopes can always be dangerous, I know, but and readers or listeners can read those on the Ship Energy website. Anyway, we looked at comparing on an energy equivalent basis the prices for different fuels, and we found that if you have a carbon price of about $200 per ton, which incidentally is about five times the current EU carbon offset price, then you could make things like methanol and ammonia price competitive on an energy equivalent basis to very low sulfur fuel oil. So, you know, this week the European Parliament has said they've come up with the technical and operational rules for putting shipping into the ETS, and it looks like that's going to move ahead. But carbon pricing is going to have to be a lot higher to drive people towards the alternative fuels, unless the investment in the fuels themselves happens rather faster. How does LR and how do the class societies work on the fuels and energy side of the equation?
I think firstly, back of the envelope calculations can be quite good in this aspect as well, because of the uncertainty ahead. Unfortunately, with email, we don't get enough envelopes. But moving forward from that, I think so. We've looked at a very similar forecast before. We've had our zero emission vessels transition pathways paper in 2019, and the techno-economic assessment of zero carbon fuels released in 2020, both in conjunction with UMass as well. And we've come out with very similar figures. We've looked at levelized cost of production, because at the moment no green ammonia is being really produced, not much green hydrogen. And there's two sides to this. We're finding future energy prices will be two to four times as much, and that can equate roughly to the figures you've come out with. And also looking at, say, the Trafigura report, which again they were talking $250 to $300 dollars per ton of CO2. So they all tie in, and there's various parts here, and the way we've broken it down in the Maritime Decarbonisation Hub is we're looking at three aspects to the challenge. We're looking at the technology readiness of the vessels, and the supply chain, the investment readiness, and the community readiness, and broken those down and really trying to see where it all fits in. As I said earlier, the ships will be ready. We can build the ships. The capex of the ships is not inhibitive. This is really going to be an opex challenge and not a capex challenge. In order for that to sort of progress, we need the investment, and the investment needs to come in. And for the investment to come in, we need the policy. So we need strong policy. So that's really under our community readiness. So we've built up this framework, which is called the Marine Solution Readiness Level Model. And we've broken that down, and we've looked at supply chain all the way through to the vessel as well. Whilst we do need whilst the price gap is needed, and again, coming back to the reasons for energy transitions and price being one of them, is that price needs to come in. But hopefully with that investment as well, is that will push down, with scaling up, that will push down the renewable electricity price, as well as the electrolyzer price as well. Because when we look at the levelized cost of production of producing the green fuels, it's coming from the electricity, the cost of electricity, and the cost of electrolyzers. And if they can be reduced, then we can reduce the price of the fuel. And hopefully over time, we won't be talking about $200 per ton of CO2. It will be much less, and we'll have an easier market. If we look at other transitions, I mean, the computing transition, the cost of microprocessors coming down was through everybody then buying computers, scaling up, and the economies of scale. So there's a lot of things going in. And I think it's very important to note that this is not just a shipping problem and a shipping transition. There are many other industries decarbonizing, and a lot of this will be done through electrification as much as possible on shoreside. But that will mean an increase in renewable electricity through solar or wind, and that will further help shipping drive down costs. And then also, when we look at those harder to abate, they are looking at ammonia and hydrogen as a means for heating and other energy methods. So particularly Japan are looking at transferring their coal-powered fire stations potentially onto ammonia. So if they're then importing ammonia, that provides a catalyst for shipping as well. When I talked about collaboration earlier, it's not just about collaboration within the shipping industry and the stakeholders. It's about going further than that as well and looking to land-based infrastructure and trying to de-risk that infrastructure development, because numerous studies have come out from anything from $1 trillion required to $3.4 trillion of the investment needed for shore-based land infrastructure. And that's a real challenge here. Is the investment on the shore side and not on the shipping side.
Yep, quite so. So shipping will decarbonize as the global economy decarbonizes, and the price of the fuels, as you say, will come down, won't it, over time, just as solar and hydrogen are now cheaper than coal on a kilowatt hour basis. So so we will get there, but yes, it took, as you said, several decades to transition from coal to oil, so it's going to take us all of the remaining time we have available to make this transition. But we can look forward to the leadership of the likes of the Maritime Decarbonisation Hub at LR to drive the policy, the technology, and the techno-economic studies that are required to move us on. Charles, it's been great to have you on board. Thanks very much for visiting today.
Thank you, Mark.
And joining us on the podcast. Appreciate you coming and taking the time. And thanks to all of our listeners. And we'll be back soon with another edition of the Ship Energy Podcast.